Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. Joining me today is Andre Luscru-Pietri, who is the head of JEDI. He's the chairman and scientific director of the Joint European Disruptive Initiative, known as JEDI. Let's welcome him. Okay. For those that don't know, JEDI's mission is to bring Europe in leadership position in emerging and breakthrough technologies. JEDI is an independent foundation working with more than 6,000 technology and scientific leaders from academia, industry, and deep tech startups in 29 countries in Europe and globally. That's a big lift there. We'll have to ask you about that. And he's here in Washington with his delegation. We'll meet a few of those folks later to talk about the growth of AI and the work. And Andre, it's so thrilling to see you again. I met you last year at the Special Competitive Studies AI Expo. I met you among 13,000 people, and I was so intrigued about the work at JEDI. But why don't you bring everyone up to date?
It's great to be here and great to see all these fantastic people in the room. In a word, we fund advanced research. We fund topics in energy and environment, life sciences and computing, which encompasses AI, cyber, quantum. And we look at topics that are too risky or too long-term for the private sector. So what you would call here in the US, the real moonshots. And we always have a mission-driven approach. That means we always look at what are the big challenges, societal challenges, competitiveness challenges that we have in energy, in life sciences, in healthcare, et cetera. And then we try to identify, are there some scientific or technological bottlenecks that with a really concerted push, we can try to break? I'll give you a couple of examples. We all know that energy transition is all about new materials. Can we find alternatives to these critical metals that first cost us a lot of greenhouse gases when we extract them, and where we also have a huge strategic dependency from some competing nations like China, for example? Can we find a solution to antimicrobial resistance, the resistance to antibiotics, which people call the silent pandemic and costs millions of lives every year? Can we identify almost real time any kind of wildfire that is starting before it becomes a huge uncontrolled wildfire where AI plays a big role? Can we develop AI that is consuming a fraction, an order or two orders of magnitude less? And we all know that today the big challenge of AI is increasingly an energy challenge. We're going to hit the wall when you see the amount of energy you need to train the latest model. So these are the things. And why do we do that out of Europe? Because without being too, I would say, pessimistic, Europe has not, in many of the technology areas, think about space, think about semiconductors, is not necessarily top of the game. We are fantastic scientists, but we have not been able to create these huge tech companies and affirm ourselves on the international stage. So we have no other choice than just to invent the next big thing, reshuffle the cards. That's what JEDI tries to do at the pan-European scale. And that's why we're here with great partnerships with our friends on the other side of the Atlantic.
Well, there's so many follow-ups there. I don't know where to start. First of all, tell us what you're doing in Washington and with this delegation.
It's now a bit a tradition because it's now the third time that together with General Palomeros, who is here, who was the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO here. Well, so we co-chair this delegation, and basically I bring part of my board and as well as some of the partners with whom we, and I'll go into that, we spend half our time doing technology horizon scanning. One of the topics which I think is the most exciting on AI is how AI is going to change science in general. What is science today is making assumptions. You have a wild idea. What if something we could develop a cure against cancer? And then you try to validate. That's happening in labs, that's happening with prototypes, etc. AI has a potential to radically change the way we just think literally out of the box about totally new assumptions. We as humans are all a bit linear in our approach, and we do a little bit better what we did yesterday. The radical changes is for us humans very difficult. So making assumptions we're going to be transformed with AI, but also validating. Think right now, for example, when you develop a new drug, how AI is going to accelerate the clinical tests. And look at the adoption time. You can today validate machines, coding, software much, much faster than you did before. So that is the role of AI in science. What we do here in Washington we meet all the heads of the large innovation agencies. So think about DARPA, think about the Advanced Research Project Agency on Intelligence, which is linked with the intelligence community. We are going to meet a bit later the director of ARPA-H, which is the newer agency who is leading that. Funnily, last year, now it's not the case anymore, all the five heads, ARPA-H, IARPA, ARPA-E for energy, DARPA itself, and OSTP, we're five women. And I think you interviewed Arati Prabhakar, right?
Yes, I did.
So
yeah,
I'm very honored to be on this line. Huh? But there's still a very big role to play for men, at least I hope so.
Yeah, you're still in, don't worry.
So we exchange on what are the topics that we think are game changers. Again, we are not doing science fiction. And sorry for those who think that we are going to teleport ourselves with a Jedi program. We are looking at topics on the 3 to 10 years horizon. What do we need to prepare today in order not to be strategically surprised tomorrow? And we think for democracies, for our Western liberal democracy, or for a liberal democracy, that's not need to be Western, it's super important that we shape the future and that we're not shaped by others who are setting the agenda. So it's really important for us to project ourselves. And it's not trivial. Again, what is the next big thing in propulsion? What is the next big thing beyond the Starship? What is the next big thing on material? And that's, interestingly, where AI is a very transversal enabling technology to do this. So one, we exchange notes. And secondly, we have, and we already have one partnership that we structured yesterday. I won't be able to tell you now, but
with
one of the big agencies that we're going to develop a joint program.
Well, but you're a science director. You've got multiple roles, but what you're trying to do sounds like really the top of the pyramid of issues. How do you work with governments and private industry? Because isn't that the key?
What is clear is that, and it's the case in Europe in particular, very often people assimilate innovation with startups. And I've been what we call today deep tech venture capitalists.
What does deep tech mean to you?
Deep tech means it's basically companies driven by advances in science and hard technology. So it's not an improvement of business model that you could see, for example, on social media. There is, of course, a technology component, but that it's mostly a business model improvement. And it's great. That is what drove the digital revolution in the first two decades of it, in 2000 and 2010. What we see since a couple of years is that you have a real emergence of companies that are able to radically change the way we develop new drugs, new materials, and this is what you would call deep tech. It's a little bit a buzzword, agreed, but basically you need very different skills to support these kind of companies. I would say in the digital revolution, it was all about business and being able to scale and expand. It was commercial. Very often, you needed to create huge brands, etc. In the deep tech revolution, actually, you need to invest often much more at the initial stage in labs. When the business model is still very far, you sometimes support people who just delivered a great research paper. So first, you need to understand it. And what I think particularly difficult is that increasingly these innovations are at the intersection of several disciplines. Think about a company like DeepMind. A very good example is basically when you see the DeepMind founders, they received the Nobel Prize in chemistry, and these are computer scientists. Is Tesla today a software or car company? So you realize that most of the disruptions today happen at the intersection. So it's very difficult because most of us and also the whole publication environment is very much linked about the silo. You are either in computer science or in biology. What is the exciting and difficult part of the times we're living in is that increasingly you need to be transversal, which makes, and to your question, the role of government so difficult because it's up to government to probably look at topics which go beyond business cases that need to be justified in a couple of years only. So they normally should be the ones in our modern societies who think about long term. Not all politicians think beyond the next 2 weeks, but that is normally the role of government. That's point one. And point two, it's all about a vision. I'm a big fan of this whole revolution when a true moonshot was launched, where you basically set a goal, but you remain very open about the way to approach it. So you create a lot of freedom, but you know where you're heading to. You can compare that for those who are sailing. If you don't know the port where you're heading to, you will get lost on the sea, but you will never be able to micromanage what is the next turn you do according to the wind. So that is what we try to do with these moonshots.
Okay, so you take the moonshot and then do you go to the European Commission and say, hey guys, this is what we're working on. If you have anything on this, we can work together on it.
To be here in the US is very interesting. Today, we have a challenge of long-term thinking within our governments. I had a short stint as the main advisor of the French Minister of Defense, so I'm not blaming. First, I think we need much more in Europe what is happening in this country or in this city, these back and forth between academia, business, and government. Agreed, it creates sometimes a lot of conflicts of interest, but these can be managed, like when you have board members who have an expertise in a field. Secondly, we are in a world that changes so fast, it's interdisciplinary. So if you only have the business view, or if you only have the academic view, or if you have only the political view, you actually much less diverse and good in your capacity to anticipate. So that's point number two. And point number three, it's up to us to also define a goal for our societies. And that's why we at JEDI don't do technology for technology. So we don't do a better AI model or a better material. We always ask ourselves, okay, can we be less dependent on metals that we're getting out of the ground? Can we find a solution to life's healthcare issue? Can we develop AI, but without getting into a huge energy crisis, which we are probably heading to right now if we continue? We always try to have this mission-driven approach, and then we leave a lot of freedom. And unfortunately, to your point, is we've seen that the traditional research system, at least in Europe, has become much more process-driven. So there are these grant applications that take 30, 40, 50% of the time of the researchers. So people spend much more time applying, and then nobody really cares so much about the outcome. We try to change that and say, okay, we're going to support you much earlier, much faster, but then we're going to be much more demanding on the impact you have in terms of scientific technological achievement. And guess what? The best people love to be challenged. I heard actually yesterday that in the US, scientists spend an average more than 40% of their time on administrative work.
AI is going to fix all that.
AI is going to fix part of it. That's why it's exciting times today. I think we are going to have new governments in France. We're going to have new governments in Germany. We have a new commission in Brussels. You will have a new administration in the next couple of weeks. There is an opportunity, without being too optimistic or too naive about it. Government is important to set a mission, but then leave a lot of freedom to scientists, entrepreneurs, and that's how our society can become much more agile. And we should not leave the long-term thinking to authoritarian states. And it is a bit the political mission we have at JEDI in a modest way.
Well, let's go back to Europe. What do you specifically want the government to do? I just got back from the Elysee Palace, where I was honored to speak at the Road to the AI Summit. We're going to get to that in a minute. But I did feel a lot of controversy and complaints about, oh, America is leading on innovation and we really need to move. But I don't hear people saying, here's the three things, pick two things. Tell me one thing that you think would make a difference right away because AI is moving so fast.
If I had to pick a topic, I think there's an obvious topic for the Europeans. I will take two, typically French. One is the obvious topic of energy and AI. I mentioned that already, but you know, Europe has been a continent that has been probably one of the first to identify planetary boundaries, the limitations that we have with our resources. And I think AI has such a promise that it should not be hampered by the limitation of resources. And it should not become also a technology that is reserved for those countries who are energy rich. And most of the countries in the world are energy poor. So if you want something that really helps humanity as a whole, I think that the one moonshot would be, can we do the same powerful LLMs like the Magnificent Seven or the big tech companies here in the US are doing, but for a fraction of the energy? By the way, your brain with your more than 80 billion neurons is working at orders of magnitude more efficiently than our current LLMs. So here I see a lot of interesting segues between computer science, neuroscience. We just discovered there was a paper that got a big prize just a couple of months ago from an American scientist living in Europe, interestingly, identifying actually how memory works. We did not know that memory now actually is emulated everywhere on the neuron and not just at a specific place. So we're just at the beginning. I think that is an exciting thing, energy and AI. And the second topic is the topic of privacy. I'm not a big proponent of tough regulation on that, but I think we are all...
Well, you're in the wrong part of the world, my friend.
No, I think it's something that you see everywhere in the world. Everybody is attached to the fact that you have your individual liberties. Some people would call it freedom of speech here. We're calling that privacy. But on the other side, you don't want to miss on the opportunity. So we have a program right now, which is to say, can we merge these big databases on mobility, on healthcare, on national security that today you don't merge because you're worried that it could be misused at one point, but by guaranteeing by design that you cannot go back to individual data. If we find that, that would be a radical game changer because you would not have to have these big brother kind of databases, but still have the promise of analyzing heterogeneous massive data and understand. The one thing that people probably can get as an image, we probably a couple of years only ago, we just crossed the moment where the amount of data available is beyond our cognitive capabilities. And so that is also a promise of AI, is can we understand a world that is inherently extremely complex? If that can be a tool for us to then make intelligence, we started with predictive maintenance to make sure that we know before it happens that elevators or airplane engines fall down. But if we have an understanding of how we could make the Las Vegas traffic or the Paris traffic much more fluid, that would allow us to discover new materials or new drugs out of the maze of possibilities we have. Biology is inherently extremely complex, and that's the promise of ours. So one, energy, and two, managing privacy and really running these big data models.
In February, the AI Action Summit will take place in Paris. And it's 6 days. It's 2 science days, 2 cultural days, and then the world leaders gather. What role will JEDI play?
Well, we're excited to announce, and that will be for you the first, that actually we've just been selected to launch one of the few challenges that will be launched with the head of states and the large stakeholders. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, wanted the first of these AI summits happened in the UK in Bletchley Park. It was focused on safety, which I think was at that moment a topic which was very important. Is AI going to take our jobs? Is there going to be a kind of a Genesis or Terminator? I think that discussion is still ongoing, but I think we have a little bit better understanding where things are heading. What the French presidency wants to do with the summit is to be more concrete. And that goes very well because our DNA is about concrete impact. They want to launch challenges to show that AI can actually solve some of these big problems. In our case, the one that we're going to launch is linked with food and agriculture. Basically, can we track how much carbon is stored in agriculture at any given time? And it's a huge impact because today agriculture is 25% of greenhouse gas emissions in total. Fertilizers alone are 10% out of these 25%. You imagine it's not just an environmental issue. Think about Ukraine. It's also a geopolitical issue. And today, no country has actually linked its agriculture, its food, and its energy policies. Today, you don't know if you promote this or this crop, well, how much it's going to store. And soils, these carbon sinks are storing a huge proportion of the carbon that is emitted. And today, the only way to know how much is stored is you do very expensive testing, and that means most of the farmers don't do it. And we think today that the advancement in Earth observation, hyperspectral observation in particular, in sensors and IoT, and mixed with AI would allow us potentially to identify how much carbon is stored. And that would have a huge consequence. Number one, it would give a value to land, to farmers. And this is still politically a very huge force in our countries. Two, it would be a nudge for agriculture to be actually a net contributor to environmental action. And third, it would be also for all these huge food companies. You think about all that are actually buying hundreds of thousands of tons of soy, of corn, of wheat. Think about the beer companies, etc. They would actually know how much is their environmental impact from what they buy. So this is one of the challenges we're going to launch. We're going to do that with space agencies. We're going to do that with sensor companies. We're going to do that with agriculture machinery companies. And we're going to do that with many of the large AI providers. And here, since it's a global challenge, we hope we will have a lot of also US
to participate
companies
in
to
it.
Participate
so
in
it's not
challenge.
Just JEDI and your 6,000 folks.
No, the 6,000 people, just to make it very clear, we are working on 40 different streams in these 3 buckets: environment, life sciences, and computing. And within these buckets, we have 6 to 10 topics that range in energy from fusion to new material to AI and energy, etc. And we try to bring together the best brains from science, from the deep tech community, from the startup community, and from industry. And we permanently look at what is the state of play today and what could come in the next couple of months. So for us, it's a machine to identify what are the right programs to launch. It allows us to prioritize resources. We talked about government before. I think one of the role of government is also to set some priorities. If you do everything, we all know that you do everything pretty badly. This is one of our call also for the European Union, is to focus on topics which are really relevant and where scale matters. Seeing that it's not done very well currently, we are trying to contribute. JEDI as a kind of a civil society, entrepreneurs, innovators come together and contribute to, I would say, common goal.
And what about China? What's the role of China? Will you work with them on this challenge or do you work with them?
First, I like to say we should rather, instead of saying China, because I know it's a very sensitive issue here in DC, I think we should talk about the Communist Party. I think we should be very clear that we have a strategic competitor in terms of values, in terms of system. It's the Communist Party. Because then the Communist Party uses the word China to say, look, these guys don't want us to develop.
But France and all the AI governments work together.
Absolutely.
And China's going to participate in the AI summit.
The French president, his vision is we should include China. Our vision is, yes, we should not exclude. And we don't say that because of ideological reasons, for very pragmatic reasons. And I heard this city will be even more dominated by pragmatism and business
deal making. That's what they say.
That's what they say. So one, it is a strategic mistake, I think, that we exclude completely, because if China becomes a black box, it's actually a huge risk for us. Think about quantum right now. Probably people in the intelligence community know much better than me, but we have no real idea where the Chinese capabilities are. And when you have uncertainty, you don't have to read The Art of War or any kind of art treaty, and the general knows it much better than us. Uncertainty is always at the benefit of those who are creating this uncertainty, because then you have these strategic surprises. You know, DARPA creation and Sputnik is that suddenly the Soviets in 57 launched a satellite. It was not a satellite, the issue, so that they used a rocket that would then be called an ICBM and made the motherland, the U.S. motherland, vulnerable. That was the strategic surprise of 57. So that is something we don't want to happen. So we need to engage just for that. And secondly, I think the Communist Party wants to say that China is one and very unified, and it was still very open to foreign businesses and foreign scientists. I think you have part of the society who has dreams. So we need also to show those part of society that we are open and we are not just pushing back. Then I think we should be not naive at all. The Communist Party wants to use technology as a way to project its own values. And I think on that one, democracies need to be strong. And what drives us at JEDI is we want, if Europe is not top of the game anymore in space, in materials, if it buys 99.5% of its solar panels or 65% of our batteries for our electric cars from China, we become dependent. So we should not develop the same batteries as the Chinese today. We should develop the next generation. Is it solid state? Is it new kind of chemicals? That's what we're working on. And too often in Europe, we are on the fast follower mode. We need our Google Cloud, or we need our hyperscaler. We need to invent the next big thing, because we're in a world where actually you can reshuffle the cards. That's a big hope I have. And I'll finish on one example. We're just celebrating 2 years of ChatGPT. The Europeans, for 10 years, they wanted to have their search engine. So they wanted to create this compared to Google. We invested hundreds of millions, if not billions, in that. All failed, of course. In oversimplification, what these LLMs allowed is this search by natural language.
Right.
So it's basically the next big thing in search. Made suddenly Google, they will come back, they're a great company, they have Gemini, etc., look a little bit as the follower.
Uh-huh.
The only question we should ask as European, why the heck didn't we do it ourselves? It should have been the Europeans who would have had a strategic interest to invent the next
piece. You can applaud. Anyone wants to applaud that. Okay. But again, I think I said it earlier. I spoke at the Elysee Palace last week. But I also had the opportunity to interview Sasha from Hugging Face, one of the great French companies. It's unbelievable. Anyone here know about Hugging Face? Okay, these are sophisticated people. It is incredible. So I would, not to be the PR person for Hugging Face France, but you guys need to get the word out. It's game changing. And I guess maybe they need like a Sam Altman or someone to go around the world and kind of push it out. But, you know, there are companies there. So what's the failure there? Is that a failure of companies, government? Is it regulation?
On a lighter note, the Europeans, I told you how hopeful I am. Let me give you some very hard data. When you look at Facebook AI research, FAIR, a third of the people in Palo Alto are French. 15% are Germans.
Menlo Park.
And they were led by Yann LeCun.
From Meta.
The big question we had when you look at challenges like the autonomous driving challenge that became Waymo a couple of years later, that now is like booming in many US cities, it was a German guy that won that challenge. Do you know that Siri was actually a challenge that was won by the Stanford Research Institute, led by a French researcher, Luc Julliard? So I'm hopeful because the talent is there. Hugging Face, you know where they're located? In New York City. They're not anymore in France. The big question we should ask ourselves is, why do these people express their talent and create these fantastic companies? Our mission at JEDI is we want to be the cradle for these fantastic brains to express themselves and really push the limits. Today, the challenge in Europe is that people often say there's not enough capital, there's not enough risk-taking. Let me try to debunk, I think, these two things. The main challenge today in Europe is that we have very fragmented markets. And the risk is the same in Menlo Park, in Paris, in Munich, or in Shenzhen. You can lose everything in these technology plays. But when it works well, you have a huge bet that goes up. Look, OpenAI, how much did it create in terms of market cap for the $1 or $2 billion that Microsoft invested? I think more than 1,000 billion since 2 years, more or less directly related to this investment. In France, in Europe, at best, you do a big French company or a big German company. When you are a healthcare company and you go from France to Germany, you need to go again through the healthcare watchdog. When you are fintech in Germany and go to France or the UK, you need to go to the FSA or the UK or the French SEC. The risk-reward proportion is much less favorable in Europe. And the double problem of that is then when a U.S. investor comes, like Mistral, the latest round of Mistral, 90% of U.S. investors. Yeah. So good for them. But once a U.S. investor comes, he also opens up, because often these investors are always coming with their operating partners and they provide a lot of business development capabilities. They then open up the U.S. market. And suddenly the potential of these companies grows. And when the potential grows, it's like on the stock market, you are able to command a higher valuation and you're ready to pay higher. So when I hear this thing, yes, they take more risk. No, the same European, when he's in the US market, suddenly he has much bigger dreams and ambitions. So the one thing we need to do, and the one thing we need to also tell our policymakers, is it's easy to announce big billions, and the commission just announced a huge sovereign fund. You can throw as much billions to European startups. If you don't create the single markets in healthcare, in cyber, in AI, in hydrogen, it will never have an impact. And that's harder than to announce billions. So that's the one thing I think we need to change, and very rapidly.
Okay. We have a special person here, your co-head of the delegation, General John Paul Palomares, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander for Transformation. First, thank you for being here. Thank you for the work you're doing at JEDI. NATO is a controversial topic here in Washington, D.C., with the incoming administration. And I think maybe you could just start with talking about the technology piece in NATO and the global challenges. That's not too big a question, is it?
Thank you very much. But let me first thank our American friends who help us to rebuild one of the key treasury of humanity, which is called Notre Dame. Thank you for that, because really. And we were so proud and so happy to see all these leaders assemble in Notre Dame. And it comes to your question. If they are there together, it's because we live in a world which is really in a turmoil, but still globally in peace. And really, my unique perspective now after my career as a fighter pilot and getting this opportunity to be ahead of a NATO command transformation, building the future down in Norfolk, Virginia. Wonderful. And this is why I joined JEDI as well, because I believe in the future and give this wonderful heritage of peace and security that we have inherited from our fathers, our grandfathers. Some 75 years ago, we had the Washington Treaty, wonderful treaties in the archive here in Washington. So this is obvious that bringing 32 countries together, because this is a number of countries which are part of NATO, which are allied, not partners, allied. It's much, much stronger. They are aligned on what? On key values. They are aligned more or less, and this is a question, on common interests. You cannot divorce common interests and common values. And they are aligned because they know that if one of these countries is in a serious position attacked by anybody, all the countries will react. One for all for one, the musketeer clause, as we call it in French. And for doing that, we need to take the best of each country. And this is true that since 1949, the major contributor to NATO in terms of capability, in terms of imagination, innovation, has been the US. And there has been this huge permanent debate on how we can share what they call the burden. Well, a burden is a bit like the treasury or the indispensable effort to keep our security and our safety. And this is where technology, to answer to your question, takes a big place. Because if we are able to outrun our potential adversary, this is the best deterrence, even better than nuclear deterrence. Nuclear deterrence is key. It has saved our peace and security since its invention. But we are able as well to build a cognitive deterrence, if I may say so, if your adversary is simply certain that in every case you will win because you have the best tools, sure, the best capacity, but as well the best people to use them, the people who are motivated. If you want to win a battle, you need three things. First, a good strategy. Putin missed his strategy in Ukraine, full stop. Secondly, you need capability and modern, adapted, cheaper, perhaps technology as well, because if you got too expensive, yes, you will get some piece of capability, but in a very few numbers. And then you see what happens when you go into high intensity, high demanding wars. And third, but not least, the will, the motivation, the skill of people, including the women. When I was the head of the French Air Force, I can tell you, I tried to unleash the women power. Yeah. And I say that because really we did that. And now we have wonderful women who are in charge of the main Air Force bases. And I'm very happy. And they did that thanks to their skills and not because we push or we provided them a special venue to do that. No, not at all. They were really treated equally and they are doing a great job. So all in all, peace, security, prosperity, which should give our young generation the opportunity to express themselves and to build a new world. And this is why I'm here, why I'm part of the French American Foundation, why I'm leading a permanent group of thinkers and with all the major people here in the government, but in companies about cyber, about the future of what you call AI, what I would prefer to call cooperative intelligence. A human plus artificial intelligence will be better than a human alone or artificial intelligence alone. This is my point. So thank you very much. I'm very proud, very happy to be here in the US, a wonderful ally, and we need to struggle, to strive to keep this alliance together. This is the best heritage that we have had for many centuries. If you reflect about the history of the world, if you have a single alliance which is able to assemble 32 countries, dedicated, motivated to keep peace and security, nothing can resist.
Can you talk a little bit about Ukraine war and the use of technology there?
This is something incredible. When I spoke about people, about ingenuity, about skills, about the Ukrainians are absolutely wonderful, outstanding, I would say. We have given them tools, and the US has done a great job, and I hope they will keep on. This is a big issue. The Europeans have done their best, but they were limited in number. But the Ukrainians did the job. They took whatever we provided them, and they thought, not in terms of number or capacity, in the outcome, the effect, the military effect. This is a good approach to the art of war. It's not the way which counts. It's how much you push on your adversary, on the center of gravity. And they have been able to invent what we were dreaming of, more flexibility, using thousands of drones. And most of them, they build themselves. That Ukraine can build more than 2 million drones a year. But they have not the money today. And obviously, Putin is trying to destroy their industry, but they are so clever. And they adapted that. One example, France provided very smart gliding bombs with propellers and sensors, etc., that we have developed through the years, which allow the aircraft to fire at distance, standoff, I would say, in security. And they adapted that to former Russian aircraft, which looks amazing for us. It would take months, years, perhaps, to do that, but they managed to do that. The Russians are good in certain domains, for instance, electronic warfare. And so they were able initially not to destroy, but to incapacitate the Ukrainian drones. Well, the Ukrainians say it's not the end of the day. We will outsmart the Russian because we will put some, and with the help of some companies, artificial intelligence, just to make sure that we can select the proper signal and that we can really resist to the electronic warfare of Russian, because electronic warfare is a key part now of our military affairs. And so they managed to do that with the support, this is true of some companies, but with very clever people who are really focused on delivering what is needed for Ukraine support. Yes, they are outnumbered. So they managed to more or less balance that. There are limits. I would stress as well that Ukrainian, in the contrary of the Russians, are following the rules of law and the rules of the military.
The Ukrainians are, but not the Russians.
Ukraine, not at all. Yeah. The Russians are striking everywhere and anywhere and anybody in Ukraine. And this is a terrible time for us, because when you see a major country which is a permanent member of the UN Security Council, when you see the Charter of the United Nations, which were agreed in 1945, just at the end of two devastating world war, wow, attacking a sovereign country.
It still takes your breath away, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to ask you this. There were reports out of Gaza that AI alone was picking the bombing targets. Now, I want you to comment on that. But the second piece is Israeli soldiers are quoted as saying that they always have a human in the loop, which is U.S. here too. But some of the other reporting is, and this is more of a thing, and maybe this is a Jedi thing, that there's something called automation bias with any technology. So it's not that the soldiers are not in the loop, but that there's a bias that if the technology tells me this, I'm just going to go do it. Can you comment in the larger picture and maybe specifically?
That's a tough question, because what is happening in this part of the world is really devastating. It comes from the history, so we must take that in consideration first. Secondly, the Israelis need to defend themselves. This is existential, and we understand that, and the U.S. are supporting him. But you're right. I have no specific information. This is me speaking, analyzing that as I do more than often in the French media as well. This is true that when you are ahead in terms of technologies and innovation, you tend to outsmart your adversary. And this is fair. Now, the question, and I have not a definite answer, but I say, do you develop AI to improve your real-time intelligence? That's absolutely outstanding. First consequence, the military commanders, the future commanders, they must be involved in developing AI tools to make sure that they are reliable, transparent, and at a certain stage, controllable, if I may say so. Because they have to make the decision. The decision relies on people, on the commander. I have been a commander. I know what it is to send people to the war and even to death if needed, unfortunately. You must remind yourself at a certain stage that everything which is automated presents a bias, because it was developed by men in a certain circumstances with their own skills, perhaps which are not adapted to what is done. So I see the challenge, and I try to be balanced. I see the challenge for Israeli.
And it's not just them, by the way. This is any use of AI in picking targets.
Absolutely. And this is a great lesson for every one of us. I'm pretty sure it's the support of many high-tech companies, and they have their own high-tech companies. It's perhaps the most advanced in that. Wonderful tools for intelligence. But the fear, obviously, is that to transform a tool which is made for intelligence and to follow all the bad guys, which is absolutely outstanding, in a tool that could be considered as a kind of automatic targeting. And I can tell you a short story because I was part of the Bosnian War, and I was the one in charge of coordinating the air operations between the NATO forces on one end and the people on the ground, the Blue Helmet. And then we had to launch major raids, major strikes against the Serbian in Bosnia, because they have, after the Srebrenica massacres, more than thousands of people died because we were not able to protect a UN safe place. So when we did that, we have no AI, but I can tell you that it was a brain effort to make sure that we didn't go too far, and a permanent discussion. So when I see that, I must say that at the end of the day, it was successful. We didn't do much collateral damage. There are always too much, but not much. And we came to the Dayton Agreement, which is still in force today. So I know the targeting process. I know the responsibility which is behind, because I've been a chief of Air Force when we launched operations against Libya. It's a tough decision, but only the human commanders can bear the weight of this decision. So I stop there because I'm not in the place of the Israeli military commanders. They are under huge pressure because this is existential for them. So they had to defend themselves, but there will be lessons. There will be lessons. You cannot put 1,000 kilo bombs like that if you have not a specific, precise targeting and a way to limit collateral damage. And this is as much as I can go to answer.
General Palermos, I can't thank you enough. I know I surprised you with all those questions, but I really appreciate. Let's thank him. And thank you, Andre. Thank you, General Palermos. Thank you all for coming today. It's Washington AI Network podcast. Please join us for future events. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.